All right, guys, welcome back to another episode of Persuasion by the Pint. I'm Jonathan Taylor, along with
Sean McCool.
All right, Sean, today we've got a fantastic, fantastic interview coming on. How to own your competitive market, charge more, and have customers love you for it. I like being able to charge more and having my customers love me for it. That's always a good thing.
That sounds like a win right there. Win-win.
That's a win-win-win, man, all around. Yeah. So
that's good stuff.
So we've got Teresa Alina. She is coming on here shortly. We're going to be welcoming her. I think she's already in the green room, but she's kind of on standby. But until then, I actually had a little conversation with her a few minutes ago. She called. So she's just going to she's gonna hang out in the green room and wait for us. In the meantime, we've got some beverages.
Got some beverages to talk about. I'm excited about mine today.
Yes.
So
you're going a little off the off your normal craft beer club this week, right?
Right. Yep. Because, you know, you've been showing up with all these like Oktoberfests and all these things. Right. And I'm like, I got to get in on that. And right now, the current case, they didn't send that. So I'm hoping next month we get into the Oktoberfest brews and all that stuff. So I was at the grocery store and I was like, I saw one of my favorite breweries, like of all time, had a new beer out, a seasonal beer. And I was like, I got to have this one. So it's Tupps Brewery, which is here in Texas. And they're the Full Grown series. If you remember those, Full Grown Man Child, Full Grown, all those. So they got a Full Grown Jack, which is like a pumpkin.
Oh, look at that with the, man, that's a mean looking pumpkin.
Yeah. And he's in a muscle, like mechanic shirt. Kind of cool. So this is a Imperial Stout with pumpkin spices.
Yeah. Okay.
So I'm trusting that Tupps is not going to let me down. Like everything I've had from them has been very good. So my expectations are kind of high. Mm-hmm. I'm kind of hoping for a 5-pint here, you know,
maybe so. On those spices, you just never can tell.
I know. Yeah. It's like, did they do it right? Cause their Christmas one was phenomenal. Yeah. So,
you had the grown man and then the, the grown man?
There's a full grown child, man child, full grown man, full grown man child, full grown Saint Nick was that's the Christmas
right.
one.
That's right. I remember that one.
Yeah. So like that's their full grown whatever is their thing. So, so if I look at this, just it says with the addition of pumpkin spices, the huge full flavored Imperial Stout just grew a little bigger. Crack it open before he takes your head. So, malt profile is off the charts. It's a little more sweet than bitter as far as the balance profile.
Is this guy supposed to be an axe murderer or something?
Well, maybe it's like the Legend of Sleepy Hollow spinoff kind of guy. I think that's maybe what it is. So what do you got over there? I've had that before, but tell the people what you've got.
So I stopped by Ace Hardware and picked me up some 10W40.
I think we're drinking the same color today for sure. Because mine is like thick.
Oh, yeah.
Dark.
Yeah. I've already had one of these. I picked this up yesterday and already had one because it's like another one of these $20 four packs. $15. And it's really dark, but it is fantastic. It is a triple chocolate. So I don't know. They've got the coffee. I don't know which one you've had, but they've got the 10W40. It's the coffee stout.
And yeah, I think that's what I had.
A triple chocolate stout.
Yeah. Can you switch cameras and show the can?
Oh, yeah. Here we go.
You're a little dark where you're at.
So. Yeah, I know. I think it's because it's really overcast today. It's been raining for like 4 days here. So let's see. It's there we go. And voila. Check a look at this.
Yep, I've had that one.
Triple chocolate. So getting good a stuff. Lot of chocolate here.
I like it.
Although I would have loved to, I was reading the, cause I was confused a little when I was looking this up and they showed me the can of the coffee version and said, this doesn't come out until November. And I thought, oh, cool, man. I kind of got a preview, you know, I kind of an early edition, but
yeah,
I was looking at the wrong one. But this is amazing. Look at that. Look at that.
So when I first had that, it was literally like, it looked like the old generic grocery store stuff. Like it was a plain white can with black lettering. It didn't have the gradient color on it. Mm-hmm. It was just a plain white can with black lettering, which I thought was actually cooler because it looked just like a, you know, just a plain, but they gotten fancy. So
you can actually feel the label on, you know, hey, you can feel some of those labels that they put on.
Yeah. Yep. So yeah. This one has the same thing. Because I think they have just the Tupps Brewery can, and then they put the, you know, they just slap the label on the.
Hold that can up again. That would, if I saw that at 3 o'clock in the morning, I think I would. I might have some issues going back to bed.
Oh yeah, I forgot to say it's 12.1% alcohol.
Oh wow. Okay.
So it's definitely Imperial Stout. So let me close my Slack. It's going off like crazy. So.
Oh yeah.
All right. Well.
All right. So I got to tell you, this is 8%. So you've completely outdone me. But it is, this one is an Imperial Stout, but it's just not a big, it's not high ABV. So,
yeah.
All right. Cheers. That's so good.
Woo.
I can already tell you, I knew my score going in because I've already
had it. So this has a lot of pumpkin. It's kind of like the one you had a while back that tastes a little bit like pumpkin pie. It's not sweet, but it's definitely like full on like pumpkin pie with the crust and everything. Mm-hmm. Like it tastes just like you're taking a piece of pumpkin pie, which is fine with me. It's not too strong. It's not too sweet.
Yeah.
But it definitely, like, you can even smell it as soon as you bring it up to your nose. It's like, oh, I'm having pumpkin for beer today.
It's an occasion. It's a beer for the right occasion, right? I mean, you wouldn't, this is not something you would have, you know.
Oh yeah. It's a sipping beer for sure. Like it's a dessert beer, sipping beer,
sure,
you know, podcast beer, but it's not like a day on the lake beer for sure. You know, okay. Round a fire pit, be good. Yeah. So I really like it. I'm probably not going to give it a 5.
Okay.
But I'm going to give it a 4.6.
Ooh, man, that's still pretty solid. Yeah,
it's really good. Wow. I think they could have just dialed down the sweetness one notch and it'd been.
Yeah.
And it may air out a little bit.
What about the spice? Are the spices just.
Spices are perfect. Like,
okay.
Yeah. I mean, it just. I mean, if you're looking for a pumpkin spice, I mean, it really should be called like full grown pumpkin pie. Mm-hmm. Not necessarily. I guess it is a pumpkin, but still. It has more pumpkin pie than pumpkin spice to me. Like I can almost taste the crust. It's weird. Yep.
That like is exactly like that one I had a couple of weeks ago. It's all I could think is pumpkin pie when I took the first sip.
Yeah, it's not like when I have a pumpkin spice latte or something at Starbucks. Yep. It's a little bit different than that. Yep. But it's good. I like it.
Right.
So what's your score?
So you just admitted on air that you drink pumpkin spice latte.
I do. I have one a year.
One a year.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
So
what's your score?
So I'm giving this like a 4.2. It's a solid beer.
Yeah.
I couldn't drink this on all occasions. It's very sweet. So
it's got viscosity.
Yeah. High viscosity. Yeah. Pretty thick. But it's a little sweet. So you have to, it's not an everyday drinking beer, but it's one of those you're going to sip after, maybe in the afternoon and have a stogie or something by the fire, or actually I couldn't do that by the fire in my house. I have to go outside, but it's one of those that's, would balance out something like a stogie, but it's not an all occasion.
Yeah.
But,
For sure. Yeah.
Definitely holiday type beer.
Yeah, we're getting into that season where it's definitely more the definitely the seasonal brews. Yep. But all right, good stuff.
Very good. Well, we have our guest just at let's see, we're at 4:30. So we're about to pull Teresa up from the green room. She is on standby. Teresa, how are you?
Good. How are you doing?
We're doing fantastic.
That's a big.
So you got to hear all of our pregame
banter.
You got to hear our pregame warm up.
It's only 1:30 in the afternoon here, so I can't start that earlier. I won't get anything done the rest of the day.
No, that's the secret to creativity is to open up the beverages a little early.
Well, I'm counting on the conversation getting wilder and wilder as we go through the
Sean, it will. I mean, he's having a really, really strong beer, so it could get crazy with him.
Pretty soon, we'll just hear his voice. He'll be under the table or under the desk. And
I've got a pretty high tolerance. I'm a pretty big boy, so I can take my first glass anyway. Won't go to a second with this one, that's for sure. Yeah.
You might want to have somebody you might enjoy having on your show sometime is Pete Schlossberg, who started Pete's Wicked Ale. Are you guys familiar with
that? Yeah. Yes.
That brand. So he actually gives marketing workshops now on guerrilla marketing. So he's got both sides of what you talk about. He might be fun to have on the show.
Absolutely.
Yeah, you
can
reach out to
him. I can make an introduction. He's fun.
That would be perfect. I mean, match our show to a T.
Yeah.
So, because we like to, I mean, marketing's a big part of that. And that's what we like to get into. And that's why, obviously, we wanted to have you on and talk about your book. So I love the title, Be the Go-To, How to Own Your Competitive Market, Charge More, and Have Customers Love You For It. I was telling Sean and I were talking before the show, you may have heard in the green room, but that's a cool title that you can charge more and then have your customers love you for that. If you've got that kind of trust, then that's really, really solid.
Yeah. The Holy Grail, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yep. So I want to introduce you to Teresa, to our audience. Do you go, I want to make sure, is it Lena is in terms of it's your last Lina. Name? Lina. Okay. Teresa
Lina. Yeah.
Okay. So Teresa Lina is joining us and she is a long time Silicon Valley business strategy and practitioner who specializes in helping companies become differentiated. Say that really fast, three times, especially after a brew. Innovative and more profitable market leaders, founder and president of Lina Group Incorporated. She has more than 25 years of strategy, technology, innovation, and marketing expertise. And I'm anxious to talk about the Apollo method for market dominance, which you highlight in your book, and we'll be talking about that today. But thank you so much for coming on and spend some time with us.
Yeah, likewise. I'm excited to be here.
So we got to give you the customary applause, the fake applause. This is the COVID distancing applause.
COVID approved.
That's
which,
great.
Which fits, you know, most sporting events right now are all fake audiences. So this fits right in with the times.
Yeah. At least we don't have cardboard guests. That's, that would be weird.
It would be.
So yeah, we were doing video calls before everything broke out. So
that's right. That's
we're ahead of the curve.
That's right. You're pros.
Yeah.
So give us a little background before we get into your book. Maybe share a little bit about yourself, your background. You know, you've worked in obviously in Silicon Valley, and that's a pretty, you know. Working in that environment, I mean, that's a pretty high stress, you know, high achievement type environment. So that's pretty cool that you're able to work with a lot of tech companies out in that area and maybe share a little bit about your background and working with companies and what led you to write the book.
Well, I started my career with a large global consulting firm. And then I actually went out on my own to start doing strategy consulting. And it was interesting because as I started working with a lot of companies, I was trying to explain, hey, you know, we have to find a different story for you because the story you're telling right now just look, it sounds like everybody else. And they could not get their heads around that. They said, no, we have the best people. Oh no, we have the best project management methodology. Oh, we have the best change management approach or whatever it may be. And I'd say, they all say that. Who doesn't say, oh, well, our people are actually not that great. Sure. So, and, it, you know, so I was trying to figure out a way to really capture for them what they needed to be doing. And then at the same time, I started experiencing some challenges with my clients where even people who knew us very well started pushing back on our pricing and wanted to get us to charge a little less because, oh, we can go get somebody to do this much cheaper, or we can get somebody to do that much cheaper. And I was trying to explain to them why we were unique and special and having a challenge with that. And so I really wanted to figure out what is it that's different. There are these companies out there that can charge multiples more than your competitors, and customers flock to them. I was on the phone with one of my subcontractors one day, and she told me about a colleague, her best friend, in fact, who was charging $50,000 a day to be doing exactly what we were doing. And I was like, and the woman actually had less practical experience than we did. And I joke in the book that I was simultaneously insanely jealous and also incredibly inspired, because I thought, wow, how does that happen? What do people do? In the meantime, I have some experience to draw on, because when I was with the large firm, it was Accenture for those people who are familiar with it. Mm-hmm. And we had built a new practice area, a new business unit within the company, and grown that very quickly to be over $800 million in revenue in less than a decade. I think it was even closer to, or maybe even over 850. And we had been breaking into a new market where we had no reputation. We were able to charge healthy margins for what we were doing. And so I went back and I reverse engineered what we had done to make that a success. And then I also did a lot of research in the market to try to figure out what is the pattern here, because I need to crack the code for my own business. And I ended up realizing that there were four key pieces that you needed to do. And if you did three, two, or one, it wasn't sustainable. You needed all four in order to make it enduring. And that seemed to be the commonality. Those four pieces seemed to be what I commonly saw. And then, of course, there were details within each of those four that made them particularly powerful. But I ended up sketching that out into what became the Apollo method for market dominance. There are four stages or phases, and they don't even necessarily have to be done sequentially. Sometimes you're doing pieces within each concurrently, but you need to go through all these four phases in order to make it last. And so so I ended up, taking that out into the market and trying it and trying to bulletproof it and get people to poke holes in it and tell me what was missing. And over time it got refined, and then I put it all in the book. I wanted to, what I didn't see in books that are out there is the step-by-step, how you go out and do this, then this, then this, then this, very prescriptive and laid out so that anybody can go make it happen. So that's what's in the book.
So before we dive into the how a little bit, let's back up a couple steps and talk about why this is so important. You kind of opened the book with why, and a great story that we're all familiar with, at least, from historical purposes. So why don't you go into like a little bit of the why of the method, and then we'll work down to the how.
So it's exactly what I was facing that I talked about, but that other companies face as well. And the problem is that when you look and sound like everybody else, over time, the only thing they have to compare you on is price. So what happens? You're at parity, you appear to be a commodity. And even though you think you're unique, from a distance, the market cannot tell the difference often. And so what happens for a lot of companies is, at a distance, they all look and sound the same. The market starts comparing you on price. You start having to slowly lower your price to compete. And over time, your margins go down to nothing, even become negative, where the more business you get, the more you're losing.
Right.
The more money you're losing.
Put you out of business.
And boom, you're dead. So once you become commoditized, it's not a matter of whether you're going to die. It's a matter of how long it's going to take. So it's absolutely imperative that companies differentiate in a very obvious, sustainable way in a competitive market. And the more competitors you have enter the market, or the more that demand gets reduced, the more this is likely to happen. So we're seeing it now, of course, with COVID and the way that demand in some markets has just dropped like a stone. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, companies are fiercely trying to scrape and claw for any dollar they can get. So that's the fundamental issue, is if you don't clearly differentiate, you are going to be commoditized and you're going out of business.
Yeah. I mean, I can't help but think while you were first talking about the commodity and us going into holiday season, like the thing that popped in my mind was like Buddy the Elf going in and seeing the world's greatest coffee sign. He's like, congratulations, you did it. But most of our customers are probably not quite as naive as Buddy the Elf. So they've probably been burned with world's greatest coffee a few times, right? You know, or whatever your niche is. So, yeah,
I mean, too many companies, people try to differentiate just on functions and features. Mm-hmm. And what happens is it's so easy, especially today, it's so easy for other companies to quickly match you. So it's basically this arms race that's an incremental arms race that you're constantly battling against. One of the reasons I named the methodology the Apollo Method for Market Dominance is that the Apollo Space Program is interestingly enough a very, very apt metaphor and parallel for what companies deal with. And the space program was facing this in the late 50s with the Cold War and the race against the Soviet Union. Mm-hmm. So every time the U.S. started to strive towards some kind of accomplishment with, you know, the latest rocket technology or getting, you know, this many more feet into the air away from the Earth, the Soviets were a step ahead of them and then trumped them. Yeah. So it was this incremental race. And so John F. Kennedy said to Vice President Johnson, you know, we need to figure out a way to just clearly get out there and dominate. What will winning look like? What will mean we have clearly won the space race on behalf of the free world? This was sort of a communist against democracy battle in space, symbolically, just like what was happening on Earth. As the Soviets had been trying to expand their annex additional countries, and there was real concern at the time that they would just keep going and, you know, take over large parts of the world, if not the world. And so Johnson went back to NASA and other thought leaders, and they said, you know, if we can send a person to the moon, now we have no idea how we're going to do it. We have a general idea. We think it's doable. But if we do that, we've won. And it's way past what we think the Soviets can accomplish. And so companies really need to do the same thing. They need to say, we're not just going to incrementally beat competitors on functions and features. We want to go out and own that market. We want to dominate. We want to be the go-to. We want to be the first name that comes to mind when somebody thinks of a certain problem that they're mm-hmm. trying to solve or a certain opportunity they're trying to capitalize on. So instead of being the commodity, you want to be the go-to. And right. that's really what this is all about.
Right. I've seen this so many times. I have a background in corporate sales and manufacturing to automotive, in the automotive markets. And I see this all the time. So you sell a product to a manufacturer and it's a chemical product. And then what happens is a competitor will get the formula or somehow reverse engineer and, you know, like come out with another Me Too product. So it's been constantly, there's a constant fight unless you can, you know, separate yourself in other ways than just the product itself. So that's the key, because all of these guys are doing it. I mean, I've seen this so many times or for so many years in sales where it's just like, well, we'll drop our price. You know, that's the answer, you know, right, and it's like, right. no, because you're just killing yourself. You're basically cutting your own throat when you do that. And you're killing the industry too. I mean, you're really downplaying what you offer and, you know, commoditizing yourself. So,
yeah. And a big key to this is becoming the go-to for that particular problem or opportunity where you're offering a solution and a result.
Yeah.
So you're focused, your whole existence is focused around outcomes and not just, hey, we're going to lay this product on the table and you run with it and make it happen. The most successful companies provide a solution so that the customer realizes and some, you know, tremendous and remarkable value. And that's when they're willing to pay you more,
right?
Because the value so far exceeds the cost of what they're paying. Mm-hmm.
So Teresa, I've got a question for you. So where my head's going, I'm trying to think of like brands that are synonymous with like being the go-to. And obviously landing on the moon is like never been done before. One of a kind, like that's great. That's also pretty hard to pull off, it feels like. So then I think about the other side, is like a company like Procter & Gamble, who continuously rolls out brands that become the go-to. And they're like, I mean, literally like Kleenex and Pampers and like, you know, her, you know, those types of names, Clorox and Tide. And so is it branding or is it actually having, like, which end of the spectrum do you think that is? Is it a little both? Like, what makes that work? Like, how, I guess this is where we're getting into the kind of, how do you pull this off? Because it seems like a pretty monumental task.
Yeah, it's on the surface, it sounds almost like complete common sense. Mm-hmm. And it's almost going to be insulting when I just hit the high level of it. But of course, the devil is in the detail.
Of course.
Execution. So there are four key pieces. One is, this is particularly critical when in super competitive markets where it's hard for the customer to really see what makes you unique. Now, Procter & Gamble has unbelievable muscle marketing dollars they can put behind things, but right. Even they fall into this, and even they've realized they have to start thinking differently about their brands and how they approach the marketplace. But I'll give you the four key pieces and then I'll talk about a couple of examples. The first piece is launch. The four phase names are launch, ignite, navigate, and accelerate. So launch is where you decide what you want to mean in the market, what problem you want to own, what your point of view is around that problem, and then how you're uniquely going to solve that problem to deliver an outcome to the customer. With Ignite, you go out and ignite the market around your point of view. So it's bigger than just your product. You have a philosophy about what needs to happen for the market to progress in this area. And you lead the charge on this, and you become synonymous with that movement toward a broad vision for the market. And then with Navigate, you actually deliver on your promises. You go out and execute. You navigate clients along the journey to solving their problem and realizing the outcomes. That's where your typical product and sales and operations and so forth come in. And then accelerate is if you've been unique, others are surely going to come along and try to imitate you. And so you want to accelerate past the competition, stay out ahead of them by continuously innovating, and then also adapting to market changes. And then it just becomes like an orbit. You just go back to launch and you're constantly cycling through the four phases as you continue to evolve and stay ahead of where things are going.
Sure.
So those are the four big pieces. So
I just realized that's an acronym for your name too.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm sure that wasn't just by accident, right?
I did. Well, here, this is what's funny. When I first sketched this out, I was actually sitting on an airplane on the way to Chicago, just trying to figure out my own strategy for my company. And I sketched this out and I put labels at the top so that I could remember the basic sure. themes. And I decided to use, I think I started with a couple of words and then I realized, oh, I should just make it L-I-N-A so I can remember it. And then over the years, I've tried like crazy to come up with different words and a different acronym that would work, like go-to or moon.
Right.
And I just couldn't find the right words to capture what you need to do in the phases. So I just stuck with that's the perfect. Acronym yeah. for my name.
Yeah, I was like trying to, that's one of my things I love doing is acronyms because my I've got a copywriting background. And so like I was trying to figure out Lyft, like what would that be? And so it's funny that you say that.
I just can't imagine that. I mean, I'm always open to suggestions if people want to send things in.
there's probably enough people in this that listen in that could, you probably get a whole handful of suggestions.
A lot of creative people out there.
Well, that's really cool. So let me ask you that. Who do you think does this the best right now in the world? Like, who's the best example of this in the world?
Well, that's no pressure.
Besides Apple. Besides Apple. Don't say Apple.
Well, I mean, Apple would be my just like go-to choice, but I wonder if that's just too obvious. And maybe that was Apple 10 years ago, not Apple today. I mean, I don't know. Apple
is one that I mentioned in the book. Certainly Steve Jobs really excelled at this. I'd say right now, one of several that's killing it is Tesla. Because, you know, people don't realize electric car technology has been around for over 100 years.
Right.
And there was actually kind of a Betamax versus VHS thing going on with electric cars and gas powered cars way back in the day. And gas powered cars took off. Electric cars just have never caught traction. And, you know, Elon Musk really cares about seeing that we get off of gasoline powered cars, and the folks who actually started Tesla originally, and they had a vision for where this needed to go. And so they had a strong point of view around what it would take to get people to embrace electric car technology. And that's really their mission, is we want to get people off of gas. We want to, make electric cars go mainstream. Now, their initial strategy was, and I talk about this a lot in the book, how to go after markets in the proper sequence so that you can get traction that leads to in one market that leads to traction in another market. And if you've ever read the book Crossing the Chasm, Jeffrey Moore goes into this quite a bit as well, but it's a very important concept. And I won't get into it too much right now. We could do a whole podcast on that, which people might find interesting. Mm-hmm. But what Tesla did is they said, okay, the first thing we need to do if we want to get people to embrace electric cars is we have to make electric cars sexy, mm-hmm. which they never were in the past. You know, they were for the crunchy granola, whatever the, you know, nicknames are for people that others perceive to be super.
The Prius and the Volt and like. You don't want to be seen driving those. You drive them.
You were kind of in a category if you were driving an electric car. And they said, no, we've got to find a way to make electric cars sexy. How do you do that? Well, you have a sports car. So we're going to make the first electric sports car that people really, really want, even if they can't afford it. And so they came out with the Roadster and they pre-sold it to shakers and movers, big names in Silicon Valley and big names in Hollywood. And so they put the Tesla name on the map and they got those people involved and they actually became brand ambassadors. And they started, doing as much to lead a movement around the Tesla name and the electric car technology as the company did itself. And then, so they got some momentum going using the Roadster and they sold that to Innovator, the Innovator personality who is okay with some flaws because the Roadster had a lot of problems, but they were okay with that. And then Tesla came out with their next model, which then attracted a different profile of person and then a next model. And then Elon Musk recently announced they're going to come out with a $25,000 model. So they're working their way into the mainstream. So he's done all the pieces. You know, they wanted to own electric cars, the electric car market. They led a movement around electric car technology, and they also provided a complete solution. So when you buy a Tesla car, you're not just buying the current functions and features, but they actually give you upgrades through the software that you didn't even know you wanted or needed. In the book, I have a story about a woman who suddenly had rear heated seats. They flipped a switch in the software and boom, she didn't even know she had hardware in there for it. So they provide a complete experience, and you know, so they don't just give you a car and then off you go. They own the whole experience, and they are with you the whole way. And they're providing a complete solution, including the app. I have another story in the book about a guy who basically watched his car being broken into, and he was able to, this is in San Francisco. He was at Levi Plaza in downtown San Francisco. These guys were breaking into his car. The car recorded it, and he was able to give the video to the cops, and they caught the guys. So, you know, so it's a whole experience, and you hear people talking about Tesla, Tesla, Tesla. And so I think they're doing a great job. They're one of several.
250,000 pre-orders for the Cybertruck. I mean, that's that's incredible. And
that's with a disastrous demo.
Yeah.
Right? You know, the demo didn't even work.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's an important piece people miss, is the mission, having that little mission. And again, that sounds like a pretty big thing. How big does the mission have to be? I mean, like electric versus gas, that sounds like a big global mission.
It depends on your market. If you're addressing a smaller, more concrete market, it just needs to matter within your market. And I refer to it as a higher purpose. And what's your higher purpose? It's beyond you. It's beyond your company. It's where do you want to see the market go? And you're going to be playing a role in taking the market in that direction.
So let's say I'm a financial planner. Mm-hmm. Like, what might that look like as a financial planner? Because, you know, they're a dime a dozen. There's one on every corner. They all do basically the same thing. By law, they kind of have to do the same thing. They have to advertise the same way for the most part. Mm-hmm. So how would a financial planner in your world break out of that and be the go-to?
Well, one of the key things you do during the launch phase is you get focused. So the big mistake that a lot of companies make, a lot of individuals make, is they're way too broad in how they're positioning themselves. And the fact is, you have limited resources. You cannot go after the planet, or you can't even go after your whole industry, right? For an individual, you might be lucky to go after a part of your city, not just the whole city, or one segment within. And I have a methodology in one of the chapters for working through your market selection. It's a step-by-step process for how you select your markets and prioritize them into a dartboard fashion. Literally make a dartboard so that you're always very clear on where you want to hit, you know, what your bullseye is for starters. And then after that, you know, the markets that go from there of, you know, where you want to, who you want to get after. But you need traction in that first market, so that you can get noticed and get some influence and some power and have a presence before you then expand. So one thing I would say to a financial planner is, who are you targeting? And most likely it's going to be way too broad. And then I would say, you know, narrow that down. So who, and the question to ask is, what are the problems out there of the people that you've been working with as a financial planner? What's the big problem you see? Oh, well, I see them, you know, they aren't clear on what they want retirement to look like. And I see that happening worst with doctors because they're terrible at managing their money. And, you know, so then the question becomes, who can you focus on and specialize in where you can become the go-to in that market? And then you can later figure out, you know, where you go from there. And then what's your point of view? So if the issue is doctors are terrible at managing their money, they don't know what they're going to do after retirement, they aren't clear on how long the money has to last. You say, you know, the problem doctors have is they squander their resources and they need a very, very clear plan for what they're going to do. And, you know, and then it goes from there. So then you would have a unique approach to helping them accomplish that.
Yeah. That reminds me of the Tom Stanley. I don't know if you've ever read the Millionaire Next Door, but he's also, years ago, he had a book on networking with millionaires, but he talks about a financial planner in that. And it's like Sean said, you know, financial planners are a dime a dozen, but he became the financial planner by showing up at the food service industry trade show. Here's a financial planner. And he had no idea what food service was about or the industry. He had no background, but decided he was going to incorporate himself and start becoming, learn as much as he could about the food service industry. And so he began developing relationships, learning about writing articles for their trade journals, and really, as you say, you know, really separating himself and not commoditizing his industry, but being very specific on what he offered. And he developed a massive business just from, you know, honing in on that particular industry.
Yeah. Yeah. And just that alone is going to make people willing to pay you a little more because they know you
have deep
expertise in their area. You speak their language, you know their problems. That's right. There's a concept, I didn't put it in the book because it's a little deeper than made sense, but it's the speed to impact. There's a curve, you know, how fast you can walk into a situation and have impact. Mm-hmm. And if you know the industry, you know, sometimes you know the company, sometimes you know the department, you can go in and have impact that much faster. And if you've seen the same problems over and over and over again, they don't even have to hear the customer talk. They could tell the customer what the problem is.
Yeah, it's really powerful when you can do that, for sure. When you can describe the problem better than the customer can, like you've got them.
Yeah.
So let me just address this, because I know a lot of people have this issue. I've had it in the past. It feels really scary to go kind of narrow like that. It seems very counterintuitive.
It's terrifying.
Yeah. What do you say to clients or to people that when you're kind of coaching them or working with them through that, like, because it is so counterintuitive. Like, it seems to make sense to go after the world, right? But
we think, if I cast a wider net, I'll catch more fish. If I cast a narrow net, I might not, you know, catch fish because they might not be where my net is. Yeah. But the key is going to where the school of fish is and cast your narrow net just around the school and not the whole lake. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the key is figuring out which market has the need. You know, where is that problem and where is it a burning problem? It's critical. It's urgent. It's common. Those are three criteria for the problem you want to identify. And where is there enough of a market to make it worth your while? Yeah. And if you're small, you can only handle so much anyway. If you're a one person shop, you know, how many clients can you comfortably handle? Well, and then how many clients do you have to talk? How many prospects do you have to talk to get the number? Let's say you can comfortably handle 10 clients a year. Okay. And how many on average do you have to talk to? Well, worst case, 10 per win. I have to talk to 10 prospects to win one client. Let's just say. So that's 100 people. So that's all you need. If you figure out a market of just 100, you'll get way more traction. If they have some characteristics in common, I mean, these can't be random people kind of sprinkled all over creation. They need to have gathering places where you'll be in front of bunches of them at a time, and they need to talk to each other and refer help to each other. So there's some characteristics that you're looking for in the market you target.
Yeah, that reminds me of Chet Holmes' Sales Machine, the Dream 100, and like finding that list of 100 ideal customers and then just working down those. And
And there's a great book for people who really have trouble with it. I go into a rationale behind it in my book, but if you want to go deeper than that and really be convinced, there's this terrific book called Focus by, I think it's by Al Reese.
Oh, yeah.
And the whole book is just one example after another of companies that focused and niched down. But if you look at some of the, almost every company that's super successful now and seems really broad started really narrow. So think about Facebook. They started out just at Harvard. And then what did they do? They said, okay, now we'll let Ivy League students in. So you have to have an Ivy League email address to get onto Facebook. And then I was, I had a Stanford email address at the time. So then they let Stanford in and a couple of other select schools got added to that. That was roughly 2006, 2007. Yep. Then they said, okay, now we'll let college students in. And then they kind of opened it up. But they got traction first with a very specific segment. Mark Benioff, when he started Salesforce, which I think a lot of your listeners are probably familiar with, CRM software, he started out it was Siebel stripped down. So they took Siebel software, which was the elephant, the go-to at the time, but it cost millions of dollars and hundreds of consultants to implement. And it was enterprise software. So you had to buy the software, implement it. And then, of course, by the time you got implementing it, it was time to change it. Sure. But he took Siebel and he stripped away functionality. He got rid of stuff. He simplified it. And then he focused just on smaller companies that couldn't afford Siebel but needed a tool like that. Tesla, as I said, focused just on those high-end people who were innovators, who loved the idea of a electric sports car and wanted to be unique. So they went after a certain profile of person. I'm trying to think. Amazon started with just books.
Yeah.
That's right. So almost every company you can think of started very, very narrow. Accenture, which is now a massive management consulting firm, started out, number one, it was part of Arthur Andersen, which was an accounting firm. Mm-hmm. And they started out just automating certain accounting functions. So just taking certain accounting functions, putting them on computers. This is in the 50s. And then they broadened into some automation of manufacturing processes. Well, actually, it was parts of accounting. Then they broadened into financial business processes, and then some manufacturing. And then they went from there.
Yeah. What Sean was saying, the whole scary idea of really honing in on a niche to begin with is scary. But, you know, when you think about it from a customer perspective, would I pay more for somebody who specializes in my field? Mm-hmm. And the answer is yes, because they know more about my industry than anyone else, than somebody, you know, if I have the option of A and B, and A is a generalist and B specializes in my industry, I'm always going to go with B, and probably 9 times out of 10, I'm willing to pay more because I feel like they have a greater understanding of the issues in my industry and in the needs that I have. So, so you can charge more at the end, you know, to make up for the, maybe the lost number of customers or clients that you have.
Higher margins, which is what you're after, right?
Yeah.
And like, if you need open heart surgery, are you going to go to a general practitioner or even a general surgeon? Or are you going to go to not just an open heart as heart surgeon, but you're going to go to somebody who's actually worked on your kind of problem? Right. And you'll be willing to spend whatever it takes, especially the bigger the problem, the more you'll spend.
Yeah, I think the other side of that is, even if you don't charge, if you can't charge more, which you usually can, but if you couldn't, like, let's say you're in real estate, for example, you know, there's pretty kind of set structure. By really focusing down on a specific, let's say, like people who have VA loans and are looking for VA approved properties, you know, so veterans, you go after that market. You're going to lower your marketing cost because you're going to get clients faster, which again, increases margin at the end of the day because you're not spending as much on marketing. So either way, you're making more money.
You're not tailoring your delivery each time. You know, you can get more efficiency in your delivery process.
More referrals and
And using templates to, you know, do the work, and you know, where you have to customize it less and less and less for each customer. There's, you know, let's look at real estate with real estate brokers on the residential side, where they're competing now with Zillow and all these online channels where people could easily go just list their house on their own and let, you know, have buyers find it. They don't have to go through the multi-listing MLS anymore. Mm-hmm. And so realtors have, you know, are struggling to justify that big, that big commission that people have to pay, especially as housing prices are getting higher and higher and higher, especially like in an area where I live, where it's insane. So a company, there's a very interesting company called Compass, which is really changing the model. So first of all, they're going around and buying up a lot of these real estate companies, and they're providing a platform to help them sell and get the marketing to be really top notch really quickly, so they can quickly get houses on the market. Mm-hmm. And they also have a wonderful program where they said, well, what's the problem that a lot of buyers face that keeps them from you know, the more we sell the house for, the more we make. So we're motivated as realtors to get the price up, but the owner doesn't want to put the money into doing what it needs to get the price higher. They don't want to stage the house. They don't want to renovate right. the kitchen. They, you know, they don't have the cash to do it.
Sure.
So what Compass does is they have a program where they will actually advance you the cash to make the, to improve your house. And you just pay it back when the house closes, no interest. So let's say I'm selling a house for, let's make it simple, $500,000, mm-hmm. and I need to put $50,000 of work into it, and I can sell it for $800,000. And so Compass says, sure, we'll loan you $50,000. They put it in your bank account. You spend it any way you want to get the house where it needs to be. And the realtor successfully gets that higher price. Compass takes their money back at closing. And you've made more money, the realtor has made more money, and they've added tremendous value. Mm-hmm. They also have a very efficient way of getting a floor plan designed for your house so that the buyer can see the floor plan. This has been invaluable during COVID when people mm-hmm. can't go do open yeah. houses or tour a lot of places. And they have, you know, a whole machine set up. This is the navigate phase. They have a delivery machine with getting professional photographs and professional copywriting and a professional, beautiful website and beautiful video. You know, it's all turnkey, and they have, you know, they dramatically increase the revenues for the agents and the customers.
Yeah, that's brilliant.
Yeah, really.
Wow. So it's a whole solution. This is an example of going from just providing a service or a product to now they're providing a total solution. Right. Or, you know, the result they're selling is we can help you make more money off of your house.
Absolutely.
So what would their mission be to kind of tie everything together in your philosophy?
Their higher purpose. Their yeah. higher purpose would be simply we think you deserve to get more than you think for your house.
Yeah.
You know, we think that the way things are done today is broken. It doesn't make sense for the buyer to have to put all this cash in. They can't do that. And yet, that's an obstacle that's stopping them from making what they deserve. You know, you should make as much money as your house is worth.
Yeah.
And to do that.
And it should be easy.
Yeah. And it should be easy and professional. You can't go to Zillow and easily get all this professional marketing.
Right.
And sometimes they will manage the process. They'll actually manage the renovations and, you know, take some of that on for you.
Wow. That's cool.
So what is the, you have in your book, the one page, the flight plan, is that kind of to summarize a lot of the Apollo steps, and if you would kind of describe what that looks like.
Each chapter that talks through the methodology. So I have, you know, a chapter that talks about what it means to be commoditized and why mm-hmm. you have to avoid that at all costs. And then what it means to be the go-to and why you would want to be the go-to, what it means to be a go-to. And then I walk through the methodology chapter by chapter. And each of those, each time I discuss a phase, I have a worksheet that helps you kind of shortcut it. So obviously you can go as deep as you want into this stuff, but I also feel this stuff needs to be super actionable. So you can come away from the book with a one-page plan for executing and just getting started. Even if you don't have all the answers right away, you can, even if you do pieces of it, you're going to increase your margins, in a short period of time. And so at the end, you put all these worksheets together into one page, and you've got basically an action plan you can put on your wall and start executing, and it'll keep you focused on what you need to do to, you know, really elevate your market position.
Very cool.
Well, it sounds like people need to get your book. So I'm sure it's on Amazon and all that, but where else can people find out more about you and what you do and all that stuff? Because you said, like we said, this is a high level overview, but I'm sure there's a lot more details in the book that people can really craft their plan. So
Yes. And my goal was, as I said earlier, to make it possible for people. This is not a hook to get you to buy my workshops and seminars and so forth. Yeah, I really want people to be able to go make it happen. Sure. So if they go, if you go to apollomethod.com, there's information, there are links to go get the book. And then when you read the book, you'll see I have a lot of tools and charts in there that help you think through the process, and those can be downloaded from the website as well.
Cool.
So you have tools you can work with.
We'll be sure to post a link to the website and where people can find it. And Teresa, we appreciate you coming on today and joining us. It's been interesting conversation. It's pretty cool. I mean, I love this. This is stuff that you know and you should address, but it's always good to hear it once more again, just to affirm yourself and think, yep, you're right. I need to be more focused and need to be, you know, sometimes niche oriented to increase the value in the market or, you know, whatever market that I'm trying to serve. So great lesson.
Well, I really appreciate you guys having me on the show. It was really fun.
Yeah. Well, we look forward to getting this out. And again, thank you so much. Hope you have a great weekend. And you take care.
You too.
All right. Thanks.
See ya.
All right. Very good. Well, that was that's excellent. So we'll be posting a link to that. You know, it was interesting, Sean, just talking to her, you know, having some of the vision, you know, the vision, because you talked about the book recently, that I've actually been going through, which is The Infinite Game by Simon Sinek.
Oh, yeah. I love that book.
He talks about, like, you know, so often, and it reminds me of our interview with Teresa, is just having that vision beyond just the product that you're trying to compete with. He talked about, you know, Apple in the book. We go back to Apple so many times, but he talks about, you know, when Apple came out with the iPod, Microsoft followed up with a Zune, you know, the Zune player. And most people forget about a Zune. No one remembers a Zune, but it was actually a really cool player. And, you know, the quality, I mean, it was a really nice player, but the problem is Apple had a vision way beyond just iPods, and Microsoft was always just following on the coattails of everything they did. And they're like, I don't care. You know, it was like, I remember he's like, he gets in, do you remember the part where the guy gets in the cab ride with the guy from Apple? From and he Apple. Said, I got to tell you, the Zoom's better. And the guy's like, yeah, you're probably right. It's like, I don't care.
Because Apple knew they had iTunes. Coming.
That's right. That's right.
Right. So they knew they had the library of music.
That's right.
They just automatically synced. You don't have to download anything. You don't have to create your own playlist.
Right.
You know, I guess you did have to create playlists still, but, you know, so like they saw that. It's just like when they built the iPhone, they already had the App Store in mind. Like they knew where it was going. So when people just tried to create another touchscreen phone, that wasn't the point. The point was you can control your life from your phone with all these apps that are coming out. And, you know, they didn't, you know, they're 3 or 4 or 5 years ahead of where we understand. So a lot of times when people are critical of Apple, and we've been critical in the past too, like they know, I think they know where they're going 5 years from now.
Absolutely.
And so that's why their iPads are getting better and their MacBooks are getting just staying the same because they know where they're going.
Absolutely.
You know, they're driving that same app culture with their iPad Pros. Now, you know, I bought the iPad Pro with the Magic Keyboard and like, it's pretty cool. Like it really can replace your laptop. It's pretty neat. But 2 years ago it could, but now it can.
That's right.
And they've been steadily working towards that. And it's, yeah, it's just amazing to have that long-term vision.
Oh yeah.
That comes out of the vision, you know, the purpose. And
it's beyond like you said, you know, they can give you a MacBook and take away your USB ports and give you these micro USB and tell you that you're going to have to get a dongle or whatever to adapt, you know, to catch up. And then they'll say, yeah, and guess what? You're still going to pay the same price, if not more. We thank you for being a customer.
Yeah, when they got rid of the CD-ROM drive, I was like, what? How am I supposed to do whatever? But they already knew that everything was going cloud-based, that you would download everything. They got rid of the headphone port, right? It's like, oh my God, like, what are you doing? But then everything went, you know, Bluetooth and wireless and like, you know, so Yeah, it's funny. Like when you really are clear on your vision and where you're going, mm-hmm. like even when there's a couple hiccups from your customers, like you actually end up doing what's better for them in the long run. You know, even if they don't agree with it at first, sometimes.
Absolutely.
I mean, Apple's a great example of that. And Tesla's kind of the same way. Like yeah. they, you know, they do some stuff that is just different than it's always been done and it works.
Yep.
So yeah, don't be afraid to be different, have a big mission, higher purpose, whatever you want to call it, niche down, all that stuff. Stuff we've talked about dozens of times.
Exactly.
So,
all right. Well, guys, thanks again for joining us. And again, that book we want to mention is Be the Go-To. Let's see, Be the Go-To, How to Own Your Competitive Market, Charge More, and Have More Customers Love You For It. And we'll be posting a link to that on our show page. You can find us on all of your favorite podcast platforms, Apple Podcast, whatever you use, Spotify, you name it. You can catch us there, download it, and leave us a review. And if you have comments, you can visit our website over at persuasionbythepint.com and reach out to us there. But as always, thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
See ya.